I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You were looking at that couple inside?
Actually, I was just looking at this little pink number over here.
Oh, yeah, that's kind of nice. They look happy, don't they?
What, the bras?
No, the couple. They look happy.
I guess, as far as couples go.
You know, it reminds me of an issue of Spider-Man I did when Peter Parker and Gwen Stacy went lingerie shopping. Of course, the Green Goblin showed up, and he pumpkin-bombed the hell out of the place. But aside from that, it's pretty much the same thing.
Oh, my God. Holy shit! Aren't you...
Oh, Stanley. Hi.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of Cinematic Universe. I'm Joe Cunningham and joining me to discuss today's news is...
Seb Patrick.
And James Hunt.
So obviously we don't get together for emergency podcasts very often where we kind of feel like we need to get in a room and discuss the news that has just broken. Today felt like very much one of those times. Just to let you listeners know, we do have a minisode coming that we've already recorded. That'll be with you later in the week. But we wanted to put this out pretty much straight away because I don't think there is a more important, influential thing that we could be talking about, guys, and that is that Stan Lee passed away today at the age of 95. Obviously, hugely important to what we talk about, which is comic book movies, but because he is one of the foundational pieces of comic books, is he guys the most important figure in comic book history?
Ooh, I mean that's a big claim to make, but he's certainly up there.
I don't think you could question he's the most important figure in superhero comics history.
For sure, yeah.
Ahead of... I mean, if people want to say that equally with Jack Kirby, then fine. But I would even say ahead of Siegel and Shuster and Bob Kane and Bill Finger, because obviously they were there at the starting point of superhero comics, which actually Stan Lee pretty much almost was as well. Just, you know, not as prominently. But I said this on Twitter earlier that superhero comics would not be an industry or possibly even a genre past the end of the 1960s if not for Stan Lee. I think DC would have withered and died without what happened with Marvel.
Yeah. We don't need to rank them. We don't need to rank who's best or most important, but certainly, you know, if you were compiling your history of comics, you couldn't get away with leaving Stan Lee out.
And so, am I right in thinking he was 40 years old at the time at which he created the Fantastic Four?
He was 39, approaching 40, if not 40, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is and he was crazy to think.
Well, yeah, and he'd been... Because as I say, like what's easy to forget is he had been working in comics since he was a teenager. Mm-hmm. He had been working at Timely, the previous incarnation of Marvel. And he'd, again, because of the fact that, like, after the war, the genre was dying on its arse, I think he became editor ridiculously young. I'm not sure exactly what age, but in the 40s, he was in charge of... you know, a not very successful comics publisher. And it gets to 1960 and he reaches this point where he's just you know, I don't want to do this anymore. I've been plugging away at this for 20 years, not getting anywhere. I want to quit and try my hand at being a novelist instead. And the way that he tells it, his wife said to him, you know, look, you know, have one more go. Just do whatever you want. Don't do what somebody else wants you to create. The way other people tell it would be that Jack Kirby came with a concept called the Fantastic Four. The way that other people tell it, Martin Goodman, the publisher at Marvel, was playing golf with his opposite number at DC, who was talking about how they created a superhero team called the Justice League, and he went away and said to Stan Lee, I want a superhero team to compete with them, create me one. However it happened, Stan Lee essentially took one last roll of the dice for a publisher that was about to go bust and a guy who was about to completely quit the industry, and instead he ensured the future of the industry for the next 50 plus years.
I think that's one of the things that I've always liked the most when I've heard people talking about Stan Lee. So obviously, the way I came into this podcast was as the movie guy who doesn't really know comics. And so Stan Lee to me was this, you know, he's the guy who does the cameos. And I knew that Stan Lee had created a lot of these characters, but you don't quite get the scope of it until... You know, I start hearing all these stories from you guys on the podcast. And I think what I particularly enjoyed was that there was this self-mythologizing about Stan Lee, and he seemed to have this hucksterish quality, but in a kind of endearing way, that it didn't feel like he was someone who had, like, conned his way to this really important status in comic books. It felt like he was a hugely influential figure who had then proceeded to have a lot of fun with that status. I mean, just showing up for God knows how many cameos he must have had. It must have been 30 or 40 in movies. He really made the most of it, didn't he?
Yeah. And
I mean, Stan Lee's biggest fan was definitely Stan Lee. It's fair to say that. But, you know, in a real way, like, the personality was Marvel. Mm. Like, one of the things that set the 60s Marvel comics apart from the competition was just, you know, the personal relationship that the editorial voice had with the readers.
Mm.
And, you know, you can praise the artistic collaborators for coming up with many ideas, but I think it would be tough to say that voice was anything but Stan's.
Mm. And you know, comics did not have that. DC were not interested in that. And if anyone wants to find out more about this, read a book which James actually recommended to me called Slugfest by, can you remember the author's name, James? I'm on the hop here. But it's a nice chronicle of the back and forth of DC and Marvel's varying successes, or rather mostly Marvel's successes and DC's non-successes over the years. And one of the things is, you know, comics and DC in particular, like, the people running them were just jerks. Like, almost every senior editorial person, as I say, especially at DC, was, I mean, you know, some fantastic creative people, but horrible people. And they did not care about fostering any kind of relationship with what they saw as the children who were reading their comics. And for all that Stan Lee, and I this is the closest I want to get to even touching on that subject in what I think should be a tribute to him rather than picking it apart. For all that you might say about the negative side of Stan Lee and his business practices and his treatment of the artists that he worked with, what he absolutely wanted to do was foster that relationship with the readers. And so, yeah, he injected the entirety of Marvel with his personality. And I don't know, because, you know him well enough, if that is a personality that he created for himself and a persona, or if that's really what he just was like. And I kind of suspect it was just what he was like.
It's certainly what he became like, if nothing else.
But it is, you know, I mean, and I think there's a tendency to kind of, people might say that Marvel were only successful because of him doing that, or that they were only successful because the stories and the art were great. And it's a combination of the two. And I think people will talk about the huckster showman, Stan Lee, and they're right to, because I saw a tweet from Tom Ewing just after the news was announced that said, RIP, the greatest marketer who ever lived. And I think he probably was. But you can't lose sight of the fact that, yes, okay, while we can talk all day long about how Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko were the storytelling geniuses and are the ones that made those stories kind of so visually engaging and flow as stories, Stan Lee put a lot of phenomenal work in those first few years to write as much stuff as he did and to do it as well as he did. And again, you know, it's only earlier this year that he died, so it's not that I want to detract from what Steve Ditko did with Spider-Man, but Spider-Man was not only Steve Ditko. And I think a lot of the human side of Spider-Man really does come from Stan Lee.
I mean, that's a point I want to make, actually, is that for any of Stan Lee's faults, he was a collaborator who brought out the best in his artists. Like Lee and Kirby and Ditko were both great creators, like fantastic artists, but they did their best work with Stan Lee. And
yeah, neither of them created anything or even turned in work anything like as good as they did with Stan Lee without him. There are people who might want to argue for Jack Kirby's Fourth World
Captain
stuff,
America.
But but you know, okay, they created Captain America, but I wouldn't say that Jack Kirby's Captain America work is his finest work.
No, quite.
I think the best Captain America stuff came along after Stan Lee brought it into the Marvel Universe. But it's just, I think you can't fathom when you look down. Because I've got here, because what I was particularly interested in was seeing which characters were created in that first year. So going from, you know, publication date of November 61 for Fantastic Four number one. And then just within a year, you've got Fantastic Four, you've got Hank Pym, the Hulk, Rick Jones is listed, but we don't need to count him. Spider-Man, Thor, Iron Man, Iron Man goes into 63, but up to October 62, you've got the Fantastic Four, Ant-Man, Spider-Man, the Hulk, and Thor. And then in the year that follows, you've got Iron Man and Doctor Strange and the Wasp and the X-Men and then the Avengers late in 63.
I mean, what have you ever heard of those characters since?
And then going into 64, you've got Daredevil and Hawkeye. You've got S.H.I.E.L.D. in 1965.
I mean, all of this goes to say, we can talk about the comic book context and him being, you know, perhaps the most influential figure in superhero comics. I'm struggling to think of many people who have had quite as big an influence on the current pop culture landscape as Stan Lee.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the people you're looking at are probably Walt Disney and George Lucas are the only ones who come even close.
Mm.
Yeah, but even then it feels like, I mean, George Lucas is someone who, he built his career on what people were doing decades before, whereas a kind of repackaging it. Whereas it feels like what Stan Lee did was, well, through the creation of those characters, through the superhero comics medium, do something different, would like create different kinds of characters that didn't exist before him. And I don't know whether, yeah, again, I don't know how much you can directly attribute that to him and how much to his collaborators. I mean, even you saying, Seb, that, you know, there's one version of that story that someone says, hey, DC have just created the Justice League, go off and create a knockoff version. That's a pretty good knockoff version, if that is the true story, isn't it?
I mean, and that's the, I think the thing that's really worth talking about is the big point of difference. And it's because I think there's, you look at like the success of the Marvel characters now, and a lot of it is down to happenstance. It's, you know, those characters are dominant in pop culture. It happens to be those characters because those happen to be the characters that a group of people got together and ran things in the right way and made those characters successful. But it's not completely random that the Marvel characters were ones you could do that with. And I think it's, I think there's kind of two reasons for it. And one is the fact that, you know, I think partly because he was rattling through having to create so many concepts in such a short space of time, every Marvel character has, at least, you know, from that era particularly, has an elevator pitch. You know, you can sum them up really easily. So even if you haven't heard of the name before a movie comes along of someone like Doctor Strange or Black Panther or Daredevil, you can very quick, someone can very quickly in one line sum up who they are. And I think as much as I love DC's rich mythological universe of characters, I don't think that's always true of their characters. But the other thing is the human side of it. Because basically what Stan Lee did that was different was to go, I'm going to create an entire universe of superheroes who are all unhappy.
And yet it feels lighter. It always to me, even like, you know, when I've been reading X-Men comics that feel like, you know, all of these characters are racked with such angst, the Marvel stuff, and I don't just mean because of what the movies have become, the Marvel stories, the characters created by Stan Lee seem in my head lighter, and I don't know whether that's because they're more, they feel more accessible because of that.
Yeah, I think, again, I think there's a couple of things go into that, which is one is it's his personality. It's, and I think, again, because you can't divorce a Marvel, even if you're reading it in a collection that doesn't have all of the, you know, the bullpen material and stuff, even just the notes in caption boxes, you can't divorce a Marvel comic from the editorial stuff around it.
So yeah,
every Marvel comic is infused with that Stan Lee alliteration and apostrophes at the end of words and everything. It's just it's just there. It lives in it and has that tone of voice. But also, it's the other major thing that he did, which is he said he created a world full of superheroes and put them all in New York and put them all in a recognisable place that people read in the comics would go, oh, that's a real world. I could bump into these. Well, you know, not if you're reading it. If you're reading it in Britain, it's still just as far away and exotic as Gotham and Metropolis. But if you're reading it as a kid in America in the 60s, you're like, this is a world. You know, I could turn around a corner and bump into Spider-Man anytime. And because they live in that real world, they just have that connection and the speech patterns that, you know, just make them feel more grounded. And I think naturally making anything feel more grounded makes it easier to put humour into it.
I mean, there's something actually that I was talking to Mike Leader about earlier, a friend of the pod, Mike Leader, who said to me actually that Standee's legacy was maybe as much the sort of ideas he came up with, in that he put these superheroes in a shared universe. And, you know, one way or another, the idea of this shared universe has become like the dominant pop culture narrative. Like the name of our podcast, Cinematic Universe, comes from this idea of these fictional characters share the same fictional space.
And comics,
and that's something he came up with. Like the idea of crossovers had been done before, but it was never in such a sort of living, breathing, organic way. It was always just Batman and Green Lantern turned up in the same city for some reason.
This is the thing, yeah. With DC, you know, they existed in the same universe going all the way back to the Justice Society, but it was, at certain times, we will do a special crossover between these characters. We will have, you know, some kind of event will happen and some kind of storyline that means that these characters, who you don't usually see together, will come together and it'll be a big deal. And in Marvel, it's just, well, they're all in New York. They're all tripping over each other. You know, again, at any time, you know, what I said before about at any time you could turn around a corner and bump into Spider-Man. Well, at any time, Spider-Man can walk around a corner and bump into Daredevil. It's the living, breathing universe. And it's not even a universe, is it? It's that living, breathing world and country and city.
those early 60s comics, like, you can track the appearances of characters from one comic to the next, and, you know, their story sort of passes sort of effortlessly between them in much the same way that it does in the movies now. Like when, you know, when Falcon turns up in one movie, it's directly informed by his appearance in the previous movie, like whichever one that was.
The first Marvel comics the first Marvel like comic stories that I ever read were printed in, well, they might have been the first, you know, they probably were the first Marvel, certainly the first classic Marvel stuff I ever read. It was printed in an annual of a British comic called Fantastic that used to reprint stuff from the 60s. And it was a 60s annual. It might be, I think it was quite late in the 60s. Might even have been like 68, the annual. But it was this old battered thing of my dad's. And the first story in it is a Thor story where Thor battles Magneto. So Magneto, having already been established as an X-Men villain, shows up and butts heads with Thor. And at the very, very end of the story, Magneto is chased away because the X-Men turn up. But you don't see the X-Men on panel. You just get a glimpse that they've arrived. And you see this submarine chasing after Magneto that's got an X on the side. And Thor's never met the X-Men. And Thor doesn't know who the X-Men are. And he just goes, "That strange sub marked with an X. What's going on?" He's like, "Maybe one day I'll learn the truth about this." And then like later in that same issue, there is an X-Men story. Although I can't remember if it's got... I don't think the X-Men story's got Magneto. It's the first Blob story. So, you know, from reading that book, I learned who the X-Men were. But, you know, my first exposure to Magneto was as a Thor villain. And immediately, the first time I read any Marvel comics, they showed me that these characters existed alongside each other and could cross over into each other's stories on a whim. You know,
it's funny, actually, because one of the, like, I got into comics and superheroes by watching the X-Men cartoon. And there was, it, even in that X-Men cartoon, there was a thing where, like, someone reads Gambit's memory, and he, in his memory, he has Ghost Rider. And then I remember being in a shop and seeing a Ghost Rider comic and being like, "Hang on a second, that's the guy from Gambit's memory." And I picked it up, and in that Ghost Rider comic, there was a one-panel cameo by Wolverine. So I immediately bought it, and that's, like, how I realized that all these Marvel heroes share the same... world was just because, like, these little moments that tie everything together.
I've got to say as well, just from my experience of reading Stan Lee's stuff that you guys have recommended, I think the things that came across were what you said, Seb, that you can... I was always very aware that I was reading a Stan Lee comic, you know, like you couldn't mistake it for anything else. Mm. And also, like, for whatever it is, 24 pages, you really got the bang for your buck with those stories. Like, I've picked up comics that I can read in, you know, 4 or 5 minutes. Whereas if I'm sitting down for a Stan Lee one, I better settle in for a while, because... yeah, it's gonna be a wordy process, but not like I've read wordy comics where I'm like, God, this is a real trek. That was never the case when you recommended Stan Lee stuff. It was always fun. As someone who doesn't really know their comics as well as you guys, It was fun going back and reading these 1960s comics that I thought, oh God, that's probably going to be a struggle, and actually kind of having a whale of a time with them. Because, I mean, what, the early Spider-Man stuff, the X-Men stuff,
well,
it was all...
Yeah, I mean, they hold up to varying degrees, and, you know, as much as I like it, the 60s X-Men stuff isn't great, and some of the other stuff, you know, it is of its time, but... I tell you, I mean, the Lee Ditko Spider-Man stuff is still as good as almost anything else in comics. And so you kind of go back to it almost with this kind of cynical eye of, oh, it's, you know, it's from the 60s.
It's, yeah, it's going to be hokey, it's going to be simple, but actually
and
it's not.
Just, yeah.
Like, there are comics of that era that you can read them and be like, this is aged poorly. Like, even at the time, this would have been a tough read. But especially of everything, the Spider-Man comics are the ones that you just read them and it's like, you know, a writer and artist firing on all cylinders. Mm. Like, they hold up so well.
Is that his crowning work as far as you guys are concerned?
I mean, it's tough to pick just one thing, but
I know there are people who'd say Fantastic Four, but for me, it's Spider-Man.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, the fertility of that period, like, if anyone had come up with just the Incredible Hulk or just the Fantastic Four or just Spider-Man, you know, they would be living their entire lives off that idea.
Yeah.
And, you know,
as Bob Kane did with Batman.
For example, yeah. You know, but Seb did the list earlier, and it's just the idea that one man could be involved in all of those creations.
Mm.
You know.
And this is why, I just can't, you know, there's been a rush. I think it's lessened in more recent years, particularly as Stan got older and sort of, you know, it came more visible and stuff, like in the films and stuff. But there was certainly a rush in the last kind of 10 or 15 years of people really downplaying his involvement in a sense to overcompensate for how the likes of Kirby and Ditko, you know, weren't as lauded for the achievements. Although somebody, it's the user, I don't actually know his real name, but know him off like Twitter and Live Journal and other things, Mighty God King, I can't remember what his real name is, but said about how actually if you look at the Marvel comics of the 60s, they do actually credit the artists a lot more than other comics publishers were doing at the time. And they did build, you know, engagement between the reader and the artists as well, even if people felt that Lee was taking too much credit for stuff. But I just can't get behind the argument that just because Lee maybe didn't fully give the due credit that they deserved then, that his involvement in all of that fertile creative stuff was nothing, because that argument just doesn't hold water at all. And, you know, now is not the time to make that argument anyway, but even aside from this, I've never thought there was a good time to make that argument.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
Because I just don't think it's right. Just so much of the character of those books clearly comes from him. And it's him working away on multiple things simultaneously and his brain going at 100 miles an hour. You know, and if you know, some of the stronger and more iconic elements of the concepts did come from Kirby or Ditko, like I say, I think particularly in the case of Spider-Man, I read that Spider-Man stuff and I feel like the stuff that more redeems the character of Peter Parker feels like it's the stuff that comes from Stan Lee.
I think that's one of the things that I was talking about when saying I'd been reading those 60s Stan Lee stuff was, I think it's all fun and it's all and enjoyable, and it was appealing to me partly because of the personality of him that comes through, and because he's someone that you can latch onto, because he's a pop culture persona in and of himself. And you talked about how much of it was him and how much of it was a cultivated personality, and we'll probably never know. And that marketing job of himself, but also, you know, because a guy could create all of these characters and then just go away. I don't know whether, has there ever been kind of like a fallow period for Stan Lee in those 55 years where you were like, oh, I wonder what Stan Lee's up to now? Because it seemed like he was...
Everything since he stopped writing Marvel stuff in the late 60s.
I mean, in fairness, right? In fairness. So he did all his character creation in the 60s. He was editor and then, you know, what was it? Maybe president or something. You know, he went off to Hollywood to try and... get Marvel's movies off the ground. So there was maybe late 70s, early 80s, he wasn't as visible as he used to be. But
because I'm not just talking about the work. I'm talking about Stan Lee as a guy, and so he's obviously, all of those characters are, you know, surviving and carrying on through the Marvel comics. Meanwhile, I was just like, in his first cartoon series debuted in 66 in terms of characters so I wrote a couple of years ago, I wrote an article for Virgin Media's website when Lucky Man, I don't know if Lucky Man's still happening, but the Sky One TV show that Stan Lee's name was attached to as a creator. And for that, I went back and looked at all of the different things that Stan Lee had done just on the small screen. And so it starts off with, he's got the 1966 cartoon, The Marvel Superheroes, which debuted Captain America, Hulk, Iron Man, Thor, and Namor. Then the first Spider-Man cartoon airs in 67. And that is one of God knows how many Spider-Man shows, both live action and animated, that have aired between now and then. In the 80s, he's got the Incredible Hulk TV show. He was a narrator on the Incredible Hulk and Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. And that's where he introduced this signing off with, "This is Stan Lee saying Excelsior." There was the Japanese Spider-Man show in the 70s. And then he had a cameo in the Trial of the Incredible Hulk. He cameoed in a bunch of he was in Entourage. He's been in The Big Bang Theory. He's been on The Simpsons twice.
Mallrats.
Yeah, Mallrats. Muppet Babies he was in. And then, I started diving into the more recent, stuff that you're like, wait, sorry, he did what? So he created Stripperella. Pamela Anderson voiced series.
If any period would be considered his fallow period, it's the point after Marvel filed for bankruptcy, and so he voluntarily left the company or was released from his lifetime contract on the understanding that he could go on to create other characters and other works. And he made a company called Power Entertainment that was an early internet startup. And actually, what happened with that was a very depressing tale of him being ripped off by his business partners. And there were a few years during the early parts of the century, millennia, whatever you want to say, where he was just sort of churning out low-quality internet content that really went anywhere.
There was the ill-fated Just Imagine Stan Lee creating DC experiments.
I mean, it wasn't necessarily ill-fated, wasn't very interesting.
It wasn't very good. It's not even that it wasn't very good, it's just that it wasn't as interesting as it could have been.
Yeah, and but then as soon as the MCU started up, he suddenly became the public face of Marvel again as these... You know, doing the cameos in the films.
But you've got to kind of admire that industriousness that's a man in his 70s going, oh, well, okay, that Marvel thing's ended. What's next?
I think
that's remarkable in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the kind of, you know, the his Marvel heyday, Marvel needed somebody like him because of all the stuff we talked about in terms of him creating that connection with an audience. And then even when he wasn't actually involved with the comics, they still needed somebody like him because it is, you know, there was nobody else like him in comics. And as I say, you know, I think around about the time of the first Batman movie, DC were kind of trying to do that with Bob Kane a little bit and kind of pushing him front and center a little bit more, but there just wasn't anybody else who was making that connection with a wider audience. And so, you know, the average person would not know that for 40 odd years Stan Lee had nothing to do with the creation of any Marvel comic. There are probably people who think that Stan Lee was still writing Spider-Man up until recently.
I mean, he was writing the newspaper strip for a long time.
Well, yeah. And, you know, when the movies came along, I think what he provided was that really important anchor. You know, he'd already been publicly visible at a time when Marvel stuff wasn't as in the public eye. And, okay, mm-hmm. you know, Mallrats wasn't a massive hit film, but the fact that a film like Mallrats could put someone like him in it, and it's like, this is Stan Lee, he's the comics guy, meant that then the movies could kind of trade on that. And obviously the cameos started off with, you know, the X-Men one, and it's just a fun little thing. But actually that unifying thread helps to create that sense of Marvel being this kind of this fun family thing, and here's Stan Lee as the figurehead of it, even when he's making cameos in the films of characters that he didn't actually create.
Or Teen Titans doesn't... Go as he does.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
quite that funny, actually.
His, because it's Stan Lee.
His last on-screen, like, in his lifetime, his last on-screen cameo was Teen Titans Go. Although I also saw someone total up, like, the movies he's appeared in, and, like, Stan Lee could reasonably be called the highest-grossing actor of all time, because yeah. he, like, the amount of money he's made is something like $26 billion.
Yeah.
Should we talk about that, because it obviously is very relevant to the interest of this podcast?
Yes.
So Stan Lee's Marvel movie cameos. So the first proper one is X-Men, right?
Mm-hmm.
That he.
It depends what you mean by proper.
Well, because, in
you it, know, he was in Trial of the Incredible Hulk and stuff. He was in all those ones too.
Okay, so theatrical cameo. So, yeah. Yeah. In a Marvel movie anyway. Yeah. So X-Men is kind of a cameo, but he's just in the background, right? He doesn't say anything.
He's a hot dog seller, I think.
Yes, a hot dog vendor.
That's the one.
So I'm trying to think which is the first one where he's actually, where you're kind of like, oh, that is Stan Lee, and they're playing on the fact it's Stan Lee. Because he was in Spider-Man, and I'm just looking, he's Man in Fair, uncredited. Then in Daredevil, he's Old Man at Crossing.
In my head, the earliest I can think of is Fantastic Four, where he plays Willy Lumpkin, an actual named character.
Yeah.
So that would be 2007?
2005.
2005, wow.
Yeah. But the other ones prior to that were Hulk, in which he plays a security guard, and Spider-Man 2, in which he plays man dodging debris. But yeah, so I'm... was it really the Marvel Cinematic Universe that kind of ramped up those cameos and made them more of a, hey, you've really got to wait until this, like, it's a moment that you should be watching out for?
I would say certainly when, like, we were looking out for them before, you know, before Iron Man came out, but Iron Man is the first one that really goes, like, slaps you in the face with, hey, it's Stan Lee.
Yeah. Do you guys have a particular favourite?
It's tough to come up with one off the top of my head.
I mean, it's the only time I'll say positively about this film in relation to others, but I think it's Amazing Spider-Man, isn't it?
The Amazing Spider-Man one is very good.
Is that the one library. Where he's in the library? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the best thing about that film.
I think his Winter Soldier cameo is very good. Guardians of the Galaxy is great. I think it's again. It talk about the personality that he called the public persona that he cultivated. It was a joy. Like every time he popped up, I kind of feel like every Marvel movie that I watch, I kind of forget that he's coming, and then he's there, and for a second it's huh. And I think it could get real old real fast. You know, like do we have to pause to do this again? But it never really did, and I'm not sure why that is.
Managed to find something to do with him, so I think.
But it feels like he's having a blast when he's doing it.
Yeah, well, that's because it's the joy on his face in all of them.
I wonder how many left we got. I think you're wrong though, James, about the last appearance, because he was in Venom as well.
He was in Venom.
Yeah. I know that the MCU had been banking up Stan Lee cameos. I think
We're definitely getting an Avengers 4 one from what I've... Well,
James
what I've
Gunn
read,
recorded
anyway.
Something like 5 or 6 during Guardians 2,
well,
I think.
They ain't going to get used, are they?
Well, that's the thing. Like, do you think they should use them? Yeah. I mean, they could.
I think if they've got ones that have been specifically designed for those films, I'd be surprised though if because that was a while ago now. Mm-hmm. There's been a significant number of Marvel movies since then. Because I know like the Doctor Strange one on the bus was filmed by James Gunn, wasn't it? Prior to Doctor Strange's production. Mm-hmm. I think we know we're getting the Avengers 4 one, and maybe that will be the last, or potentially Spider-Man Far From Home.
I sort of think even if there are ones stored up, they should maybe cap it off at Avengers 4.
It feels like, it feels like having an endpoint for it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Avengers or Spider-Man, I think, would both be...
Yeah, if, assuming they've already been written in or produced or whatever, but let's not drag it out. Let's give him some dignity.
I'm already not looking forward to seeing the next one, particularly if it comes in Avengers 4, which is,
it's already going to be an emotional time.
A Captain Marvel one. Yeah, exactly. So it's already going to be an unbelievably emotional roller coaster of an experience, and to have that in the mix as well.
I'm not looking forward to the end card on Avengers 4.
Oh, God. Yeah. It's like with Paddington 2 with Michael Bond. I mean, it's not to quite the same extent, but that was still quite... I knew it was going to be coming, and it...
So, guys, for me, Stan Lee is obviously someone who I can acknowledge the importance of, but I imagine for you guys, this was one of those that, like, hits you square in the chest when you read it.
Yeah, I mean, this was my Bowie.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've talked about kind of ones that I think will be the, people who you would expect might not be that long left, and when it happened, how big they would be. And I think Stan and Tom Baker are the two that I was thinking when they happen, it's going to be really tough. He did make it to 95, which is really impressive. That's the point. All these cameos started when he was in his 70s.
Yeah.
But it is just, no matter how long someone has lived for, when they do,
there's never a right time to die, right?
Exactly. It's still emotional. I think particularly because he'd been so visible throughout all of these last few years, and with these appearances in the films and with doing conventions and stuff, but let's not talk too much about that side of things. It's a really big loss, and it feels weird as well, I think, because obviously earlier this year we had Steve Ditko, and we would have talked about that, and obviously that's as the co-creator of Spider-Man, who I think James and I can reasonably argue as one of the greatest fictional creations in history, and certainly of the last 50 years or more, to have not quite afforded the same reaction to Steve Ditko, because we didn't know him in the same way and he hadn't been as visible in the same way. But I think it does actually add a bit more sadness to Stan Lee going now that it wasn't that long ago that we lost Ditko as well.
And Joan Lee.
Yeah.
If there's any upside to this, is that, he's reunited with his wife, however you want to interpret that.
It's that sad thing that often seems to happen when you have men who've been in these, very long, decades-long relationships, and then when the wife passes away first, the husband's not often long afterwards. Thankfully, Mel Brooks has stuck around for quite a while after Bancroft.
Seb, I know you mentioned it quickly as something not really wanted to dwell on, but obviously the situation around Stan Lee for the last couple of years was concerning, and we spoke about it on the podcast. I do think it is a hugely positive thing that was resolved prior to his death. That's not the story that we're talking about now. That is something that was addressed and resolved, and presumably, to the best of our knowledge, Stan Lee spent his last months in a much better situation than he had been.
I mean, ironically, the fact that we actually, I think, seem to see and hear actually a bit less about him was probably a good thing. We don't know kind of, if he was ill or whether this was kind of a long illness or anything, but just, him not suddenly not being wheeled out so much in recent months, I think, you know, affording him that privacy and dignity a bit more will definitely have been a good thing. But as I say, you know, I think with all of us, you know, would that we make it as far as 95.
Yeah,
you know, the fact that this is somebody who was not only, you know, we've lost a lot of influential figures from the Silver Age of comics in the last few years. This is somebody who was around in the Golden Age of comics and working in the Golden Age of comics, and there are even fewer of those left, if there are any. It's, you know, yeah, it's about as big a happening as I think we would expect to happen in comics in our lifetimes since Jack Kirby died in 94, which I think for some of us was at a point when we were probably too young to be following and understanding that side.
Yeah,
of things.
I mean, I remember Jack Kirby dying and seeing it on the news as, again, X-Men cartoon. Like, they, you know, the X-Men cartoon was big at the time and they reported it in the context of the guy who co-created the X-Men. You know, this cartoon phenomenon has died, and that was in the early 90s. But at the time, I didn't know who Jack Kirby was.
Mm. And even then, you know,
I can imagine
still...
Stan Lee will be making as many headlines.
Well, yeah, I mean, even, you know, Jack Kirby will have had, I think, some exposure to a wider audience, but it will still have been to people who were interested in the characters via something like a cartoon. You know, this is Stan Lee, this is Mr. Comics, and it's, I don't think there are many people who wouldn't at least recognise the name. As I say, even if they think, oh, Stan Lee's that guy who writes and draws all of the Marvel comics.
Think he's that guy who turns up in every Marvel film for some reason.
there's nobody else like him in comics, and there won't ever be anybody else like him in comics, you know, for as long as the superhero comics industry goes on.
No matter how much Mark Miller tries.
Yeah. There won't be any one person who has that influference on it and that, you know, people's awareness of them. And as I say, I think it's just, for all of the potentially darker side of his personality and some of the stuff that he would have done, he just made everything so much fun. Somebody posted a bunch of pictures on Twitter of just him, various publicity pictures of him with people in like Spider-Man costumes and stuff. And I think they'd captioned it, you know, there's one thing you could say about Stan Lee. He really got that work and pleasure balance just about right. And that's true. He's just someone who just, you would very rarely see a photo of him without a big, massive, shit-eating grin on his face. And, you know, it's nice to see that someone lived for that many decades like that.
I think we'll probably be drawing this to a close shortly. This tribute, I guess, is what it is to a titan of pop culture and of superheroes. I want to ask you guys a question and see whether you would agree or disagree with this. James, I know you've mentioned this before, and I've heard the debate had on House to Astonish about who are the most iconic characters, fictional characters. And it was, what have you said before? Maybe like Superman, Mickey Mouse, and Jesus?
I think Superman, Mickey Mouse, and Sherlock Holmes are there.
Yeah. I was having a joke. I would posit that in 2018, I think Spider-Man has overtaken Superman. And I would now like to open that to the floor to discussion, because at least I can't speak to worldwide. The S might still be, you know, so much more recognisable in Asia. I don't know. But I don't see the kids running around in Superman costumes the way I do with Spider-Man, and like,
no, I mean,
and the toys and the cartoons and then you could say, oh, well, it's a character that kids like, but it's not. It's a character who now, not just for like commercial reasons, well, driven by commercial reasons, but there's a reason why Spider-Man, the studios couldn't leave Spider-Man alone. because people want Spider-Man movies. Even when the movies are bad, they go, right, okay, like, try again and give us a good one. It feels to me like Spider-Man is that iconic hero now that kind of you go to 9 out of 10 people in the street of all ages and they would know who Spider-Man is.
Sorry, go on, Jobes.
I was just going to say, like, the, you know, Superman's the archetype, and I think he'll always be the archetype. Certainly, by this point, I think Spider-Man is as recognisable.
I think in a more immediate sense, Spider-Man is. And it's also, what I was going to say was, I think the interesting, if you were to ask 100 people, name a superhero, what would be the first one that would come to mind? And I think Superman might even be in third place behind Spider-Man and Batman in that kind of immediacy. But I think to be described as big a character in terms of recognition, I think you've got to have that for a longer period. And it's whether Spider-Man... You know, I think if things were to continue on a trajectory of people keep making popular and successful stories with Spider-Man in and they don't do the same with Superman, then maybe Superman starts to become a bit more of a background, not exactly forgotten, but, you know, a used-to-be character. I think in 2018, Spider-Man has more cultural currency than Superman, definitely. Hmm. Whether, you know, he is more recognisable than Superman, I don't know. I know that my daughter, if anyone now, like, my daughter considers putting some kind of mask or hat or something over your face as being Spider-Man, which is her granddad's fault because he does it with a red bandana thing that he has. So now she does that with her own hat. She pulls it down over her eyes and says, I'm Spider-Man. You know, it'd be nice to think that Spider-Man, because as I say, you know, I think he is sort of, you know, one of the greatest fictional creations. So I'd like to see him up there with Sherlock Holmes and Jesus.
There's a crossover.
I think his contribution to comics, to superhero comics, to pop culture, the amount of joy, of entertainment that Stanley's work and latterly his creations have brought to the world is almost immeasurable. And at 95, he is a huge loss. I just saw the Guardian's obituary calling him perhaps the last legend of popular culture. And it's hard to argue with that. He'll be sadly missed, but Stanley is dead at 95. Listeners, we will be back later in the week with a mini episode, and we've got our next main episode coming up not too long after that. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.
You know, I guess one person can make a difference. Enough said.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are...
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.